Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, you are tuned into the WUNC Politics Podcast. Glad to have you along for this first edition of a March podcast here in 2018. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for clicking play with us today to talk about elections, 2018 midterms, legislative seats, congressional districts, and perhaps we'll even touch on a state Supreme Court race as well. Is the executive director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, Jonathan Kapler. Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
Hey, good. How are you?
Glad you're here.
Thanks.
It was a crazy day yesterday.
Yeah.
A lot of activity there at the end. Give me a couple of just general takeaways.
Sure. Yeah. This was an unusual year in North Carolina politics, as evidenced by our candidate filing, which closed just yesterday. And we always have a glut of candidates that file at the beginning and a glut of candidates that file at the end. But what was unique this year in North Carolina in 2018 is the fact that we had really what essentially is 170 legislative seats that will have a Democrat and a Republican candidate. You compare this to 2016, and at the close of filing, there were essentially 41 people who were elected to the North Carolina House because they had no opposition, and 13 members of the North Carolina Senate that were elected because they had no opposition.
So you're saying, just to drop a quick time out in there, that effectively in February of 2016, we knew who was going to, barring some crazy unforeseen disaster, who was going to represent those districts because there was no competitors, there was no competition.
Right. So you pay your $207 filing fee and you effectively won that seat. And that is not the case this year. Both parties spent a lot of time, effort, and resources recruiting candidates across the state to run in all 170 legislative districts effectively. And all told, though, it's not just 170 times two.
Right.
We're looking at close to 500 legislative candidates that have filed. There will be primaries in 74. There will be 74 primary elections, both Democrat and Republican, at the state legislative level, involving 37 incumbents. We've got 18 legislators who are not seeking reelection. We've got 20 open seats, 12 in the House, 8 in the Senate. So it's a lot going on.
Right. A lot of numbers. Numbers don't always work well with radio. Let's take just through a couple quickly to, I guess, not even, I don't even know the best, just kind of poke holes at it. You mentioned 18 lawmakers who are not running in the seats that they currently hold. Give me the most interesting name of a lawmaker who is not trying to retain his or her seat.
Certainly. Well, I'll give you two. One is important because it's a long-serving legislator who's stepping away, Representative Mickey Michaud from Durham County, 19 and a half terms, long-standing member of the General Assembly. But his district is safely Democratic, right? So that's not impactful as it relates to 2018 elections. You look at someone like Representative John Bluss from Guilford County, whose district was altered, one of the ones that was altered by the special master that the three-judge federal panel had appointed. His district had shifted and become much more friendly to Democrats.
Right. He's a long-time Republican.
He is a long-time Republican, and he is stepping away. And so that makes that seat much more likely to flip to become a Democratic-held seat.
All right, let's stick with Michaud for a second, because my read on that is that he wants to handpick his successor. Is he going to be able to do that?
In this case, it largely looks like that will be the case, given that there was only one Democrat that filed, Zach Hawkins, very Democratic seat. There's a Libertarian and a Republican that are running in that seat, and so you never say done until it's done, but that looks like it's going to work out for him.
All right. A ton of candidates, as we mentioned off the top. If you would, tell me about the primary season first. We're heading toward a May 8th primary,
right.
I believe. And a number of incumbents are challenged. What are the 3, 4, 10, if we want to go that many, what are the main primary races of interest?
Certainly. Well, and our initial take at the Free Enterprise Foundation is out of the kind of 74 legislative primaries, there's probably 22 that are probably worth watching closely.
So 22 out of 74 between a third and a fourth.
Yeah.
Okay.
And some of those involve incumbents. Some incumbents traditionally have a routine primary challenges. Some of these will fall off and not become super competitive. But you think of someone like Representative Justin Burr in kind of South Central North Carolina. His district got tweaked a little bit, but it looks like he's got a legitimate primary challenger. In Charlotte, you've got a couple of Democratic lawmakers, Senator Joel Ford, who's got, I think, three mm-hmm. Democrats that are challenging him. He just came off that Charlotte mayoral bid in which he did not, he was the third place finisher out of three. And I think there's some concern that he is not progressive enough sure. for that district. Same thing, Rodney Moore, Democrat from Charlotte, facing challenges from his own party. But then you've got really interesting things developing in some of these open seats. You've got an open seat in kind of the Triad area, Iredell and Yadkin counties, mm-hmm. and you're seeing the potential return of former Senator Bob Rucho, along with three other Republicans in that Republican-leaning seat. And so some of these folks are newcomers. Some of them are folks who've been around and are making a return trip, right. potentially. And then some are, I think, it's a overall indication of the unsettled nature of the politics of the country and the state, that there are so many people interested in throwing their hat in the ring.
And Rucho is not just any North Carolina senator. He's one of the most dynamic, colorful, combative, and influential of, I don't know, maybe the last 20, 25 years? Is that an overstatement?
No, he was a leader of tax reform in North Carolina after Republicans took the control of the majority in the General Assembly in 2010, former Finance Committee chair, and you know, represented Mecklenburg County, but has since moved to Iredell County, which is in this new Senate district that was open. And interesting there, I mean, I think that he wouldn't be running if Republicans were super pleased with the candidates that had thrown their hat in the ring there. And I would say that he's got to have a leg up in what is a crowded primary.
Let's step back. 120 seats in the House. All of them will be challenged, R versus D. 50 in the Senate, all challenged, R versus D. This has never happened before.
Right.
As you and several others noted on Twitter, on social media yesterday when I asked the question. More competitors, more competitive?
Yeah, question mark. I don't think so.
Okay.
Not necessarily. This is really going to boil down to the same places that we anticipated it boiling down to before.
And
there's going to be a handful of competitive state Senate races, a handful or more of state House races that are competitive, and those are largely going to be in suburban areas in the state. Many of those seats are Republican held. There are a couple, especially because of redistricting and some shifting district lines, where some Democratic incumbents are drawn into some districts that are really becoming more Republican-friendly territory. But there's two or three of those where Democrats will be playing defense in rural areas. But by and large, we'll be focusing more in the suburban communities in North Carolina.
Before I forget, you can read a lot more about what we're discussing today, get more of an analysis, look at those numbers online, which is at least better for my brain and how my brain tries to work, at your website, which is ncfef.org.
Correct.
NC Free Enterprise Foundation, the acronym, .org. Okay, so well, the real end game here, the name of the game, is about whether or not the Republicans can defend these supermajorities, whether the Democrats can take them, depending on how you want to look at it. But Democrats would need to retain what they have and pick up four seats in the North Carolina House. Republicans on the Senate side have to just not lose six seats, right? So you talk about where the gains or the swaps, the switches could be. Mm-hmm. We're talking about suburban areas, Wake, Meck.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the heart of it. Is it Guilford or New Hanover?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you definitely the focus is going to be on Wake and Mecklenburg counties. I think there are four Republican House members in those two counties each. You've got some, I think, potentially competitive races in Guilford County, New Hanover, Wilmington area, certainly. The districts that we're using in Wake and Mecklenburg County, we are pretty sure, are ones that were drawn by Republicans,
right.
As opposed to the special master.
Right.
The Democrats were hopeful that we would be using the special master maps, and that is apparently does not seem to be coming to fruition. And so they were destined to be competitive races, but on the margins, right, these things matter, especially in what looks like it'll be a low turnout election.
You have a little bit of tentativeness in your voice because there is still a lawsuit lingering that could, in theory, change some of the districts in Wake and Mecklenburg. But we don't, to be clear, expect that to happen. Is that I don't expect that to happen.
That's correct. Right.
Okay. I want to touch briefly on Representative Duane Hall before we just move on to other things. I want to talk about, some of the campaign issues and so on and so forth. But as it pertains to the primary, there are a number of incumbents who are challenged. One of them is Dwayne Hall, who's a third-term legislator from Wake County. There was a piece that emerged this week. It was published by North Carolina Policy Watch, which is a division of the North Carolina Justice Center. And in it, they talk about they have these harassment allegations that are made against Representative Hall. He's a three-term lawmaker from Wake County. And what has happened, and as we chat on a Thursday afternoon, this very well could change the dynamics of this later today or tomorrow. Democrats have called on him to resign. The governor has called on him to resign. The allegations within this piece are, I think, persistent or pervasive, persistent sexual innuendo. Allegedly, Representative Hall tried to kiss somebody at a gala, a Democratic North Carolina quality gala, quality NC in 26. That's just some of the background on that. From a political standpoint, I'm going to go ahead and say that there's a decent chance that he steps down in the next 24 or 48 hours, just based on the calls that have happened. If that is to happen, what happens with I believe it's House District 11?
Right. Well, and by North Carolina law, his name would remain on the primary ballot. There are two other Democrats that filed in that district at the last minute. To women. He theoretically could win that primary, in which case he could withdraw at that point. The party could replace him. But if he decided to resign, it would probably mean that one of the two other candidates would win that, I would suspect. But is that seat is very Democratic, and despite these allegations and the calls for his resignation, it would be very difficult for it to flip.
Said North Carolina law requires that the candidate's name remains on the ballot. Is there an instance in which a candidate's name could come off the ballot, convicted of a crime, death? Something else?
There are challenges that happen, and a lot of it's based on residency and those kinds of things. Okay. And so the total numbers that we've got right now, about 473 candidates, may change a little bit as some of these things happen, and the State Board of Elections dots their I's and cross their T's.
Well, follow up there. Hadn't put this on paper, but we do not have a State Board of Elections right now.
Right.
This is a continuing to play out in the court spat between Berger Moore v. Cooper. We just don't have and for 100 years, the state has had a 5-member State Board of Election and a 3-member Board of Election within each county. This is at the behest or is to reflect the party of the governor. We don't have that right now. Staying away from the arguments, the partisan arguments or the whatever arguments right. on what needs to happen. What does happen if, for example, Steve Smith, and I'm making that name up, is a candidate in Iredell County, and somebody challenges Steve Smith and says, wait a second, Steve Smith actually lives in Davie County. He can't run for that seat. If a challenge is to come a day from now, a month from now, what happens?
There's an administrative process that staff drives, and then because there's no board, if there's not a board at that time, it goes to the courts.
Okay. And, Superior Court.
Exactly. And so the State Board of Elections staff and the Superior Court have become very friendly with each other because that's the way all this stuff is. It's slower and it's not efficient and it's a real challenge, but that is the process that we're living under right now.
Jonathan Kapler, Executive Director of the NC Free Enterprise Foundation, is your guest here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. It was the close of candidate filing season this week across North Carolina. We've been talking about the legislative races. We'll touch on congressional races as well. I want to stick with these swing legislative races or these in-play legislative races. Wake and Meck largely is what we're talking about. By your estimation, what are the issues that are going to matter? I mean, we can wipe out Currituck County and we can wipe out Rockingham County as part of this question. Is it Me Too? Is it guns? Is it the economy? Is it education? What is it that's going to drive these voters?
Right. Well, we were chatting earlier about the word that I keep using for North Carolina politics is dynamic. And you'll hear me say it a lot because it is. Part of that is that the issue set, I think, keeps changing. It's impacted by what's going on nationally, internationally. It's going to be impacted by what the legislature does in the short session. So it really shifts from issue to issue, I think, from time period to time period. And frankly, it could be impacted on a daily basis by what the president decides he wants to wake up and tweet about. But the bottom line is that campaigns are often more about who wins the argument over what narrative are we campaigning on. And if Republicans, or if the narrative that voters are most focused on in campaign center around economic themes, I think that that's probably good news for Republicans. If it's about other issues, if it's about control and partisanship and redistricting and pollution issues, Gen X here in North Carolina, mm-hmm. those kinds of things, potentially education funding, then that might be better news for Democrats. And so it's not necessarily who's kind of giving the best answer to the argument. It's what is the argument about.
This is not... So what I'm hearing you say is not necessarily even in the messaging, it's in the framework of the messaging.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Exactly.
A Republican operative said to me this week, you know what they need to do with this short session? They need to come in, they need to give teachers raises, they need to give state employees raises, they need to maybe slightly alter the tax code, and I'm going to edit myself here, and they need to get the F out of there, and they need to go home. What can lawmakers do in the short session that would help them come November?
I think a short session is generally in their best interest, and I think most people think that they've got the incentive to do that. I think over the course of the past few years, the polling has indicated that the longer they stay in session, the more the Republican legislators' polling numbers go down. So I think it's going to be a relatively short session. They will come back into session shortly after the May primary and hopefully wrap up shortly after the end of the fiscal year, which ends on June 30th.
No presidential race in 2018, no Council of State races, with Burr having won in 2016 and Tillis having unseated Hagan in 2014. We are now in that two-year cycle where North Carolina does not have a Senate race.
Right.
This all is to say there is not a big and there are national bits of rhetoric and policy and messaging that are going to affect what happens in North Carolina, mm-hmm. but there is not a statewide race of significance. That's not taking anything away from the Supreme Court race. We'll come back to that in a second. My question is this. What can you forecast for a voter turnout? The last time this happened, no presidential race, no U.S. Senate race in North Carolina was 2006. General election turnout, 36.5% of registered voters. Primary turnout was like just less than 12%. Not great numbers.
Yeah.
Does that hold this year?
I think that it'll be a relatively low turnout affair, despite the fact that there's a lot of interest of individuals wanting to run for office. The fact that we don't have a marquee statewide contest to draw voters to the polls and for there to be a funnel of national money coming into the state of North Carolina for a competitive race like that, I think definitely translates into fewer folks turning out to vote. Now, this is a super consequential factor, though, as it relates to North Carolina politics, because what happens is that low turnout elections favor the party that's more energized, even more so than is typical in a regular midterm election cycle, which is obviously typically lower than a presidential election cycle. North Carolina averages around 70-72% in a presidential election cycle turnout. And
that's pretty good.
Yeah, and about 42% in a normal midterm election cycle. But as you noted, in 2006, it was even lower, which was the last time this happened. And so if you think about it, this could be kind of death by a thousand cuts for Republicans as it relates to their supermajority, which you are exactly right. That is the central question for North Carolina politics is, can they maintain their supermajorities? But for Democrats, they're hoping that some shifts in some of the district lines in suburban communities, some of those suburban voters that had traditionally been Republican shifting away from the Republican Party because they are not in love with President Trump, and you've got lower turnout in general, and you've got even lower turnout in North Carolina because there's no statewide contest, and you've got potentially a more energized Democratic base because of President Trump. And those marginal changes, and you think about state house districts, they're small. A few hundred voters is a big difference between winning and losing.
To that point, how closely do you track turnout within districts? Or I can flip this on us. How much does the media incorrectly make of voter turnout statewide? Voter turnout in Duane Hall's district, whoever ends up running in there, or Phil Berger's district or Tim Moore's district, that's somewhat inconsequential. But the voter turnout of Bill Brawley's district or of Nelson Dollar's district or I think of John Alexander, he's in the Senate, so a little bit bigger of a district. But we're talking about whatever it is, 70,000, 75,000 people in each House district. I don't know what my question is. What is the how closely are you looking at voter turnout?
You're hitting the nail on the head. There's going to be super uneven turnout across the state. And you even have to look and factor into things like hot sheriff races where the community is very engaged in that. And that almost has kind of an up ballot effect, right? There's reverse coattails in those situations. And I've been paying attention to where there are potentially competitive congressional races come November.
Okay.
That might be the second district in the Triangle area and south. That might be the Triad, the 13th congressional district, and that might be the 9th congressional district from Charlotte over to Fayetteville. And I look at those races that might be potentially competitive and therefore national resources coming into the state for that, and then what the state legislative races are that are in that same area.
If you know, this is a curveball, give me the range of voter turnout that you would expect. Like, what's the lowest district, not specifically the district, but like in the lowest districts, we're going to see what, 15-20% or 25-30%? And in the highest, are we going to see any districts with 80% voter turnout? No.
Well, I think you're going to be doing real well if you've got certain jurisdictions that are hitting kind of 50%. And that'll probably be where it tops out. And you will see some places where it might be kind of 10 to 15% simply because of where they are. And a lot of the communities around military bases in North Carolina typically have a very low turnout in non-presidential election years.
Potentially a couple of quick hitters here. There is a race for state Supreme Court. Barbara Jackson is the Republican. Anita Earls is the Democrat. This is for an 8-year term in the state Supreme Court. Give me a dollar figure. How much money is going to pour into this race from outside of the state?
Well, that's the question, right? It's not what the candidates raise. No. It's what the outside groups spend. And North Carolina has a history recently over the past couple of election cycles of attracting a lot of money, millions of dollars, to influence the outcome of these races. We've seen them go both ways, to a candidate that's identified with the Republican Party, a candidate that's identified with the Democratic Party. I mean, it could be, you know,
just millions or tens of millions?
Yeah, tens of millions is probably high.
Okay.
But especially because we aren't going to have super high ad rates in North Carolina because we don't have other competitive statewide races. That's what drives up the price of these things. And I will say that increasingly as technology gets more and more advanced, the ability to target voters gets more sophisticated and it's pushing further down in the political process. And so state legislative candidates and their campaigns can pretty much target candidate or voters who they know are going to turn out in a low turnout election. And so that may, you know, reduce the costs in some places.
We haven't discussed congressional races to this point. At the moment, the split is 10-3, 10 Republicans, 3 Democrats representing North Carolina in the U.S. House. I think everybody's got a general election challenge with the exception of Walter Jones in the third, but he's drawn 2 Republican primary challengers.
Right.
We keep hearing about George Holding gonna have a fight, but you know, advantage is his for now. David Rouser in the ninth, in the ninth is perhaps going to be the most contested race. What has changed? What's new on the congressional front, if anything, for you?
Yeah, that's really where we're going to see those national factors play out because voters are not going to have a Senate race to kind of express their will, their antipathy towards the president or their support. And, you know, increasingly, our country is becoming parliamentary in the way in which we approach elections. It's less and less about the individual candidate, I think, and more about whether or not someone wants a Republican or Democratic vote in Congress or in that legislative body. And so you've got voters. You saw this in Alabama, right? The special U.S. Senate race down there is a lot of voters that voted for Roy Moore, the Republican nominee, didn't like him, but they were afraid of losing a Republican vote in the U.S. Senate. And so he wound up narrowly losing. But it's going to be the same thing congressionally. The question is, do you want to empower the president or restrain him? And so you're probably going to be using your vote to express that up and down the ballot. And you're exactly right. The 2nd, the 9th, and the 13th districts are where that might take place.
Do we have any indication, and it's early, whether or not we are seeing any more moderate candidates? I think of a Chuck McGrady in the North Carolina House. I think of actually a guy like Brian Turner, who's a Democrat in a district that I believe tilts like 2 or 3 points Republican, or at least it did. I don't think that one was redrawn. You and I and so many are just talking about this hyper-partisan moment we're in and candidates kind of stretching further and further to the polls. And I would note in some conversations I had this week, a rift is too strong of a word, but there have certainly been conversations within the Democratic caucus on the House side about all of the candidates that were recruited and a lot of the pretty progressive candidates that came forward. And there are some Democrats in the North Carolina House who think, you know, is this the best way for us as Democrats to go out and get more seats? Do we have to come back toward the middle? Can we come back toward the middle? So that's just a little bit behind the curtain of some of the conversations that I was listening to or involved with this week. Any more moderate candidates from your early estimation? In closing, was just yesterday.
Yeah, it's hard to say at this point, especially with so many. I will say that you've got to look at what the political incentives are, right? If the main concern is a primary, then no. If you're gunning for a district that maybe leans slightly towards the other party, then the party behooves itself to find people that can speak to those types of voters. And what you saw the Democrats do nationally in 2006 under the leadership of Rahm Emanuel, who's now the mayor of Chicago, is that he went out and recruited Democratic candidates like Heath Shuler in Western North Carolina that could speak to and represent a district that was more conservative than the National Democratic Party was. And I think that the Democratic Party it's been harder and harder for them to do that, to speak to rural voters, blue-collar voters that have started to shift by and large to the Republican Party. And conversely, I think it's harder for Republicans to effectively win over urbanizing voters and including in some of the close-in suburban communities in North Carolina.
What haven't we touched on that's important to be thinking about at this point in the game, conceding that it's month 3 going to month 11, quick math, that's 8+ months before an election.
Right, yeah.
Plenty of time for fighting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a roller coaster ride. I think you've got to look at the fundamentals of a long-term political campaign here. You've got to look at factors like retirements and whether or not they help a particular political party. You've got to keep in mind X factors like an international crisis or a terrorist incident, which does impact things like legislative races, right, that candidates don't have control over. You've got to keep in mind the fact that historically the midterm election cycle goes against the party in power in Washington. And right there, there's unified Republican control of both chambers of the Congress and the White House. But you also have a new factor in North Carolina where you've got a sitting Democratic governor who's in relatively good standing. And so does that help? It certainly helped, I think, Democrats recruit candidates. Does it help funnel money into North Carolina? Nationally, I think you'll probably see some of that. And that campaign finance infrastructure is just increasingly complicated. You cannot just look at candidate fundraising or party fundraising. You've got to look at that. You've got to think about what the outside groups are doing, how organized they are, how well-funded they are, what type of group it is, what they can spend their money on. Individuals can spend money. I mean, it's increasingly complicated. And so you've got to piece all that stuff together. And unfortunately, we don't always have the access to that information in real time. So we have to kind of do a retrospective on these things following the election.
A few rapid fire and admittedly totally unrelated to get us out of here. 10 words or less, describe the wave you expect to see in November.
Cross currents. I think you're going to see some factors mitigate other factors in North Carolina. And so it's not going to be a clean win for anybody.
I this is radio, so no one can see this, but I'm looking at you. You've got the solid socks on. You get the blue suit with the brown shoes, the tie clip. I'm dressed a little bit more like a schlub today. But best dressed lawmaker at the North Carolina General Assembly, male or female, of course.
That is a great question. You know, I think Representative Jason Sain stepped up his game when he became chairman of the Finance Committee. So I think he
finance reports notwithstanding. That was him, right? Okay. We'll edit for content. Maybe we won't edit. It's all in there. Favorite spot to go get lunch in downtown Raleigh when you've got an hour or less?
Oh, that's a great question. Centro. Yeah.
UNC Duke Hardwood Saturday night. UNC caught the first one at Chapel Hill, and you are pulling for whom? Which team? On Saturday.
Well, so having been a former advocate for the UNC system, I feel like I have to go with them. Although I will say, as a proud North Carolinian, I like the fact that we have the best rivalry in college basketball.
And I would render to say college sports.
Yeah.
There are some good ones in college football, but Duke UNC is as good as it gets. Jonathan Kapler, Executive Director of the Free Enterprise Foundation, thank you for coming back on the podcast and dropping all sorts of knowledge.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. As always, you can find the program on iTunes or Google Play. Reviews are encouraged there as well. Give us a rating. Download the program. Share it with a neighbor, friend, colleague, whatever. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with you next week. For Jonathan, I'm Jeff.